Chapter 16. I thought you were worthy of confidence. I said, yes, sir. He said, I gave you a letter from certain of my constituents in the state of Nevada asking the establishment of a post office at Baldwin's Ranch and told you to answer it as ingeniously as you could with arguments which should persuade them that there was no real necessity for his office at that place. I felt easier. H, if that is all, sir, I did do that. Yes, you did. I will read your answer for your own humiliation. Washington, November 24, Messrs. Smith, Jones, and others. Gentlemen, what the mischief do you suppose you want with a post office at Baldwin's Ranch? It would not do you any good. If any letters came there, you couldn't read them, you know, and... besides, such letters as ought to pass through, with money in them, for other localities, would not be likely to get through, you must perceive at once, and that would make trouble for us all. No, don't bother about a post office in your camp. I have your best interests at heart, and feel that it would only be an ornamental folly. What you want is a nice jail, you know, a nice substantial jail and a free school. These will be a lasting benefit to you. These will make you really contented and happy. I will move in the matter at once. Very truly, etc., comma Mark Twain, for James W.N.U. S. Senator. Apostrophe, that is the way you answered that letter. Those people say they will hang me if I ever enter that district again, and I am perfectly satisfied they will too. Well, sir, I did not know I was doing any harm. I only wanted to convince them. Ah, well, you did convince them, I make no manner of doubt. Now, here is another specimen. I gave you a petition from certain gentlemen of Nevada, praying that I would get a bill through Congress incorporating the Methodist Episcopal Church of the state of Nevada. I told you to say, in reply, that the creation of such a law came more properly within the province of the state legislature, and to endeavor to show them that, in the present feebleness of the religious element in that new commonwealth, the expediency of incorporating the church was questionable. What did you write? Washington, November 24. Rev. John Halifax and others. Gentlemen, you will have to go to the state legislature about that speculation of yours. Congress don't know anything about religion. But don't you hurry to go there either, because this thing you propose to do out in that new country isn't expedient. In fact, it is ridiculous. Your religious people there are too feeble, in intellect, in morality, in piety, in everything, pretty much. You had better drop this. You can't make it work. You can't issue stock on an incorporation like that, or if you could, it would only keep you in trouble all the time. The other denominations would abuse it, and hear it, and sell it short, and break it down. They would do with it just as they would with one of your silver mines out there. They would try to make all the world believe it was ill-cat. You ought not to do anything that is calculated to bring a sacred thing into disrepute. You ought to be ashamed of yourselves. That is what I think about it. You close your petition with the words colon and we will ever pray. I think you had better. You need to do it. Very truly, etc., comma Mark Twain, for James W.N.-U.S. Senator. Apostrophe, that luminous epistle finishes me with the religious element among my constituents. But that my political murder might be made sure, some evil instinct prompted me to hand you this memorial from the grave company of elders composing the Board of Aldermen of the city of San Francisco, to try your hand upon a memorial praying that the city's right to the water lots upon the city front might be established by law of Congress. I told you this was a dangerous matter to move in. I told you to write a non-committal letter to the alderman, an ambiguous letter, a letter that should avoid, as far as possible, all real consideration and discussion of the water lot question. If there is any feeling left in you, any shame, surely this letter you wrote, in obedience to that order, ought to evoke it when its words fall upon your ears. Washington, November 27, The Honorable Board of Aldermen, etc., gentlemen. George Washington, the revered father of his country, is dead. His long and brilliant career is closed, alas, forever. He was greatly respected in this section of the country, and his untimely decease cast a gloom over the whole community. He died on the 14th day of December, 1799. He passed peacefully away from the scene of his honors and his great achievements, the most lamented hero and the best beloved that ever earth hath yielded unto death. At such a time as this, you speak of water lots. What a lot was his! What is fame? Fame is an accident. Sir Isaac Newton discovered an apple falling to the ground, a trivial discovery, truly, and one which a million men had made before him, but his parents were influential, and so they tortured that small circumstance into something wonderful, and, lo, the simple world took up the shout, and, in almost the twinkling of an eye, that man was famous. Treasure these thoughts. PC, sweet PC, who shall estimate what the world owes to thee? Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. Jack and Gill went up the hill, to draw a pail of water. Jack fell down, and broke his crown, and Gill came tumbling after. For simplicity, elegance of diction, and freedom from immoral tendencies, I regard those two poems in the light of gems. They are suited to all grades of intelligence, to every sphere of life, to the field, to the nursery, to the guild. Especially should no board of aldermen be without them. Venerable fossils, write again. Nothing improves one so much as friendly correspondence. Write again, and if there is anything in this memorial of yours that refers to anything in particular, do not be backward about explaining it. We shall always be happy to hear you chirp. Very truly, etc., Mark Twain, for James W.N.-U.S. Senator. Apostrophe, that is an atrocious, a ruinous epistle. Distraction. Well, sir, I am really sorry if there is anything wrong about it, but it appears to me to dodge the water lot question. Dodge the mischief. Oh. But never mind. As long as destruction must come now, let it be complete. Let it be complete, let this last of your performances, which I am about to read, make a finality of it. I am a ruined man. I had my misgivings when I gave you the letter from Humboldt, asking that the post route from Indian Gulch to Shakespeare Gap and intermediate points be changed partly to the old Mormon trail. But I told you it was a delicate question, and warned you to deal with it deftly, to answer it dubiously, and leave them a little in the dark. And your fatal imbecility impelled you to make this disastrous reply. I should think you would stop your ears, if you are not dead to all shame. Washington, November 30. Messrs. Perkins, Wagner, Ayat. Gentlemen. It is a delicate question about this Indian trail, but, handled with proper deftness and dubiousness, I doubt not we shall succeed in some measure or otherwise, because the place where the route leaves the Lassen Meadows, over beyond where those two Shawnee chiefs, dilapidated Vengeance and Biter of the Clouds, were scalped last winter, this being the favorite direction to some, but others preferring something else in consequence of things, the Mormon Trail leaving Mosby's at 3 in the morning, and passing through Jawbone Flat to Blucher, and then down by Jug Handle, the road passing to the right of it. And naturally leaving it on the right to, and Dawson's on the left of the trail, where it passes to the left of said Dawson's and onward thence to Tomahawk, thus making the route cheaper, easier of access to all who can get at it, and compassing all the desirable objects so considered by others, and, therefore, conferring the most good upon the greatest number, and, consequently, I am encouraged to hope we shall. However, I shall be ready, and happy, to afford you still further information upon the subject, from time to time, as you may desire it and the Post Office Department be enabled to furnish it to me. Very truly, etc., Mark Twain, for James W.N.-U.S. U.S. Senator. There now, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't know, sir.
It appears to me to be dubious enough. Do leave the house. I am a ruined man. Those humbled savages never will forgive me for tangling their brains up with this inhuman letter. I have lost the respect of the Methodist Church, the Board of Aldermen.
Well, I haven't anything to say about that, because I may have missed it a little in their cases, but I was too many for the Baldwin's Ranch people.
General, leave the house. Leave it forever and forever too. I regarded that as a sort of covert intimation that my service could be dispensed with, and so I resigned. I never will be a private secretary to a senator again. You can't please that kind of people. They don't know anything. They can't appreciate a party's efforts. A fashion item written about 1867. At General G.'s reception the other night, the most fashionably dressed lady was Mrs. G-100. She wore a pink satin dress, plain in front, but with a good deal of rake to it, to the train. I mean, it was said to be 2 or 3 yards long. One could see it creeping along the floor some little time after the woman was gone. Mrs. 100 wore also a white bodice, cut bias, with pompadour sleeves, flounced with ruches, low neck, with the inside handkerchief not visible, with white kid gloves. She had on a pearl necklace, which glinted lonely, high up the midst of that barren waist of neck and shoulders. Her hair was frizzled into a tangled chaparral, forward of her ears, aft it was drawn together, and compactly bound and plaited into a stump like a pony's tail, and furthermore was canted upward at a sharp angle, and ingeniously supported by a red velvet crupper, whose forward extremity was made fast with a half hitch around a hairpin on the top of her head. Her whole top hamper was neat and becoming. She had a beautiful complexion when she first came, but it faded out by degrees, in an unaccountable way. However, it is not lost for good. I found the most of it on my shoulder afterward.
I stood near the door when she squeezed out with the throng. There were other ladies present, but I only took notes of one as a specimen. I would gladly enlarge upon the subject were I able to do it justice.
Riley newspaper correspondent, one of the best men in Washington or elsewhere is Riley, correspondent of one of the great San Francisco dailies. Riley is full of humor, and has an unfailing vein of irony, which makes his conversation to the last degree entertaining
as long as the remarks are about somebody else.
But notwithstanding the possession of these qualities, which should enable a man to write a happy and an appetizing letter, Riley's newspaper letters often display a more than earthly solemnity, and likewise an unimaginative devotion to petrified facts, which surprise and distress all men who know him in his unofficial character. He explains this curious thing by saying that his employers sent him to Washington to write facts, not fancy, and that several times he has come near losing his situation by inserting humorous remarks which, not being looked for at headquarters, and consequently not understood, were thought to be dark and bloody speeches intended to convey signals and warnings to murderous secret societies, or something of that kind, and so were scratched out with a shiver and a prayer and cast into the stove. Riley says that sometimes he is so afflicted with a yearning to write a sparkling and absorbingly readable letter that he simply cannot resist it, and so he goes to his den and revels in the delight of untrammeled scribbling. And then, with suffering such as only a mother can know, he destroys the pretty children of his fancy, and reduces his letter to the required dismal accuracy. Having seen Riley do this very thing more than once, I know whereof I speak. Often I have laughed with him over a happy passage, and grieved to see him plow his pen through it. He would say, "I had to write that or die, and I've got to scratch it out or starve." They wouldn't stand it, you know. I think Riley is about the most entertaining company I ever saw.
We lodged together in many places in Washington during the winter of 67-8, moving comfortably from place to place, and attracting attention by paying our board a course which cannot fail to make a person conspicuous in Washington. Riley would tell all about his trip to California in the early days, by way of the Isthmus and the San Juan River, and about his baking bread in San Francisco to gain a living, and setting up ten pins, and practicing law, and opening oysters, and delivering lectures, and teaching French, and tending bar, and reporting for the newspapers, and keeping dancing schools, and interpreting Chinese in the courts, which latter was lucrative, and Riley was doing handsomely, and laying up a little money, when people began to find fault, because his translations were too free, a thing for which Riley considered he ought not to be held responsible, since he did not know a word of the Chinese tongue, and only adopted interpreting as a means of gaining an honest livelihood. Through the machinations of enemies he was removed from the position of official interpreter, and a man put in his place who was familiar with the Chinese language, but did not know any English. And Riley used to tell about publishing a newspaper up in what is Alaska now, but was only an iceberg then, with a population composed of bears, walruses, Indians, and other animals, and how the iceberg got adrift at last, and left all his paying subscribers behind, and as soon as the Commonwealth floated out of the jurisdiction of Russia the people rose, and threw off their allegiance, and ran up the English flag, calculating to hook on, and become an English colony as they drifted along down the British possessions. But a land breeze and a crooked current carried them by, and they ran up the stars and stripes and steered for California, missed the connection again, and swore allegiance to Mexico, but it wasn't any use. The anchors came home every time, and away they went with the northeast trades drifting off sideways toward the Sandwich Islands, whereupon they ran up the cannibal flag, and had a grand human barbecue in honor of it, in which it was noticed that the better a man liked a friend the better he enjoyed him. And as soon as they got fairly within the tropics the weather got so fearfully hot, that the iceberg began to melt, and it got so sloppy underfoot, that it was almost impossible for ladies to get about at all. And at last, just as they came in sight of the islands, the melancholy remnant. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.